gentlemen. Our first case this morning is United States against Sun. Mr. Lemoore.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Doyle Max Lemoore. I'm the attorney for Bobby Suggs, and I'm appearing on the consolidated brief along with Paul Strachey and MacArthur Drake for Shaunte Suggs and Aaron Davis. This case comes to you as a criminal prosecution in the Northern District of Indiana, the Hammond Division. The defendants were indicted along with numerous other individuals for various drug-related offenses. The principal charge contained in the indictment was conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute cocaine base. After being found guilty by a jury, Bobby Suggs and Shaunte Suggs were sentenced to life imprisonment, and Aaron Davis was sentenced to 405 months of imprisonment. Two issues are raised on the consolidated brief. The defendants first contend that introducing evidence of their purported gang affiliation with the Vice Lord Street Gang impermissibly substituted for direct evidence that they joined a drug distribution conspiracy and was unfairly prejudicial. They also contend that introducing evidence of photographs of their tattoos and the gold crown of a tooth was unfairly prejudicial. On the first issue, to establish that a defendant's a member of a conspiracy, the government needs to prove both its existence and a participatory link with each defendant. The government, in this case, attempted to satisfy these evidentiary requirements principally by expert proof that the defendants were affiliated with the Vice Lord Street Gang. In the language used by the government to characterize its own proof of gang affiliation, this evidence is the glue that holds the conspiracy together. Without this proof, the evidentiary requirements necessary to establish the conspiracy cannot be met. Bobby Suggs, Shaunte Suggs, and Aaron Davis believe that proof of their purported gang affiliation with the Vice Lords was improperly admitted into evidence by the district court for several reasons. First, evidence of gang affiliation has been recognized by this circuit to be inherently and significantly prejudicial. Affiliation with a street gang conjures up images of criminal activity and deviant behavior and is insidious in its implications for the jury.
How is one to avoid it in a case where the gang is the conspiracy? How can one talk about one but not talk about the other?
Well, I think you have to make a distinction, Your Honor, between affiliation with the gang, which is not a crime, as we argue, and membership in the conspiracy, which is a crime. The easiest way to prove gang affiliation is by direct testimony of it. In other words, if the government here would have had two or three witnesses who came on the stand and said, yes, I know Bobby Suggs, Shaunte Suggs, and Aaron Davis are gang members, that's the easiest way to do it. Doing it with expert testimony, however, as it was done here, where there's an
Did the defendants offer to stipulate that they were members of this gang?
Oh, no, I think they opposed it throughout
the whole trial. Then it's very hard to complain that the prosecutor put on more or better proof. I'm sure the defense would love it if the prosecutor could only put on just a little proof rather than lots and lots of proof.
Well, I think that hits upon a point, Your Honor. The question is unfair prejudice. And to some degree,
most defendants think proof of their guilt is unfair prejudice.
Well, we understand that all evidence to some degree is prejudicial, but the gang evidence here, I think, crosses the line. It goes too far. This circuit has clearly recognized about the damage that it can do and that it's insidious.
Well, we've also held, though, that it's not necessarily error to permit gang references to be in the case here in Chicago as well.
Certainly, gang evidence can be relevant. There are cases that say that in this circuit. But the unfair prejudice, I think, is a question of how much of it you're going to permit. And here there were, there are a number of instances where the gang evidence repeatedly came up. It came up in Mr. Gropentian's testimony. It was repeated after his testimony. There were references to gang tattoos. There was evidence of illegal activities by the gang. It came up repeatedly, and I think if you're asking whether there's unfair prejudice, it's a question of whether the prosecution has gone too far or not. And in this case, we believe that they have. So the gang evidence, we think, was unfairly prejudicial and simply crossed the line here. And whenever there's a question of unfair prejudice, to some degree, it's going to be a question of degree. I'll discuss the second issue, Your Honor. The second issue is whether introducing evidence of photographs of defendants' tattoos and the gold crown of a tooth was unfairly prejudicial. Evidence is recognized to be unfairly prejudicial if it induces the jury to decide the case on an improper basis, commonly an emotional one, rather than on the evidence presented. As this circuit has stated, the more probative the evidence, the more courts will tolerate some risk of prejudice from its admission. Less probative evidence will be received only if the risk of prejudice is more remote. The tattoos and crown of the tooth introduced here have low probative value, but high prejudicial effect. The probative value is low because they're subject to plausible or innocent interpretations regarding their meaning and symbolism. For example, the word insane on Bobby Suggs' tattoo has many potential meanings, including not only psycho, crazy, or loco, but also deranged, nuts, or mad. And none of these meanings suggests any conceivable relationship to the Vice Lords. The prejudicial effect, on the other hand, from introducing this evidence is high because it was admitted to prove affiliation with what amounts to a notorious street gang, and evidence of gang affiliation has been recognized by this court to be inherently and definitely prejudicial. The bodily decorations or adornments like tattoos, and by extension also the crown of the tooth, also violate some basic cultural prohibitions that are a strong and important part of the Judeo-Christian tradition. And this fact almost ensures that in the jury's perception, the evidence would be very prejudicial. For these reasons, Your Honor, we believe the risk of prejudice from admitting these items of evidence far outweighs their probative value, and we believe that the decision to admit them should therefore be reversed. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. McLemore. Mr. Vicalis.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Peter Vicalis, and I represent Benjamin Johnson, who the government and their agent admitted was a secondary subject in this case. In my opinion, he was a fungible street dealer who on tape sold approximately 2.5 grams of crack cocaine to an informant and was subsequently sentenced to the maximum sentence allowable, full 20 years in prison. It's true that the plea agreement that the defendant signed contained a provision wherein he waived his right to appeal. Yet here we are in the appellate court. The defendant tried to withdraw his plea somewhat clumsily by sending a letter himself before contacting counsel. He sent a letter to Judge Moody informing Judge Moody of certain things, and then at my client's instruction, we prepared a written motion to withdraw his plea. The district court denied the motion without a hearing, and that is the basis, the primary basis for our being here today. The district court also, after sentencing Mr. Johnson, despite that provision in the plea agreement, reminded counsel of our duty to continue to represent Mr. Johnson on appeal, and essentially told Mr. Johnson that perhaps this court would grant relief, and the defendant instructed counsel to proceed with this appeal. Mr. Johnson acknowledges that his burden of overcoming the presumption of verity of his statements made to the court at the plea. But the defendant alleges in his letter to Judge Moody and in the motion that I filed subsequently that he had communications by two different assistant United States attorneys threatening him, that they were going to bring new charges and have co-defendants testify against him about other matters, and that further, he did not fully understand the concept of relevant conduct, or in his words, irrelevant conduct. The court asserted in its order that it was, that the defendant was, quote, perfectly aware, unquote, of the implications of his guilty plea. However, we suggest that that is a conclusion that that can't be made without there being some sort of a hearing of taking testimony from the defendant about his allegations.
Well, but see, that goes to the heart of taking pleas.
Yes, sir.
You have to accept face-to-face answers that are given by a defendant when a plea is taken. I mean, there may be some extraneous information would come in to set it aside, but how does a judge take a plea and assume that the answers you're getting are truthful?
Well, in this case, the defendant's confused state of mind, I assert, would be easily understood when one considers what he saw was about to happen to him, that he was going to be held responsible for the full weight of this conspiracy in spite of the fact that he is was a low-level functionary. And when he saw that he was going to be, that they were going to attempt to have him held, be held responsible for the full weight of the conspiracy despite that fact, is when he filed his motion to withdraw the plea. The government alleges in its brief that that act by Mr. Johnson attempting to withdraw his plea is inconsistent with acceptance of responsibility, and I would argue that that is not necessarily true. His motion only came when he realized that he was going to be held responsible for the entirety of the conspiracy. He accepted responsibility for what he did. It's not frivolous or a false denial for a defendant to say, wait a minute, I'm taking responsibility for what I did, but you're asking me to take responsibility for what everybody did, for what the leaders of the conspiracy did, and that is not something he was capable of doing. The FBI agent, Mr. Brookwalter, at sentencing, acknowledged that there was no evidence of wealth on the part of Mr. Johnson, that he was a secondary figure. The expression I use to describe a guy like Mr. Johnson is he's fungible. He's a street guy that the big shots in the conspiracy use to do their business. And he's supposed to just stand there and let a train run over him, or else he's going to be denied the coveted, to use Judge Moody's word, a credit for acceptance of responsibility. Mr. Johnson argues the contrary, that the credit for acceptance of responsibility was earned by him, and he's asking this court to grant the relief sought. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kirsch.
May it please the court. I respond to the appellant's arguments in the manner in which they raised them. First, respond to the evidence of gang affiliation and the gang tattoos that were displayed to the jury. And second, responding to Benjamin Johnson's arguments regarding the plea hearing and the acceptance of responsibility. With respect to the defendant's gang evidence, or with respect to the appellant's argument that the gang evidence was unduly prejudicial and impermissibly substituted for direct evidence of the conspiracy, it did not. In this prosecution, there was overwhelming evidence that all three defendants who went to trial were members of the conspiracy. There was overwhelming direct evidence of that, in addition to the gang evidence. In this case, the gang controlled the conspiracy. DeSalle on the Hill, DeSalle with the other members of the conspiracy, one had to be a gang member. The appellants now complain of the quantity of gang evidence introduced at trial. However, throughout the record and throughout the trial, the defendants maintained that CCA was nothing more than a legitimate rap group, that it was not a gang. It was important to establish that it was much more than a legitimate rap group. In fact, it was a conspiracy to distribute large, large quantities of crack cocaine. They complain about the witnesses who testified that they were members of the gang. However, these witnesses had to establish that they were in fact members of the conspiracy, that they were accepted into the conspiracy, and that they were able to sell drugs with the conspiracy. And to do so, they had to establish that they were also members of the CCA street gang. The Vice Lord evidence came in and was admissible and was properly introduced to explain the CCA gang. These individuals used signs, they used symbols, they had tattoos that to an average juror, they'd have no idea what they were. CCA was closely affiliated with the Vice Lords. Thus, the expert testimonies to explain what these individuals were doing in all these photos with their hand signs, what their tattoos depicted.
What was the reason for the picture of the gold tooth?
The gold tooth, Your Honor, was a five-point star. Throughout the trial, Aaron Davis, the appellant who had the five-point star carved in his gold tooth, maintained that he was not affiliated with the Vice Lords. He was only a rapper, and he was a successful rapper. He was simply a member of the CCA rap group, not a member of the Vice Lords. He made it a point to the jury that he had no tattoo, that he had no Vice Lord tattoo on his body, that he had no signage of affiliation with the Vice Lords. However, carved on a gold crown on his tooth, he had a five-point star, which is affiliated with the Vice Lords and shows his affiliation to the conspiracy as well as the CCA rap group. There were nothing about these tattoos that were inherently inflammatory, such as demonic symbols or other things that this court has taken issue with. One appellant had "insane" written on his shoulder, the other had a Black Panther and a five-point star, and Aaron Davis had the five-point star carved into a gold crown. There was nothing inflammatory about these tattoos. Finally, as to Benjamin Johnson and his argument that he should have been allowed to withdraw his plea, Judge Moody had a very detailed plea hearing and went over with Mr. Johnson in detail the relevant conduct and also coercion. And I submit to you that no assistant United States attorney coerced Mr. Johnson into pleading guilty. And Mr. Johnson explained that to Judge Moody. He told Judge Moody that several times, and Judge Moody asked him several times during the plea colloquy if he had any questions, if he understood anything, if he fully understood relevant conduct, if he discussed it with his lawyer, and on and on and on. And Mr. Johnson never hesitated, not even once. Once the pre-sentence investigation report came back and Mr. Johnson realized that he was looking at a offense level of 40, he asked to withdraw his plea. He didn't like the sentence that he was about to get. He should be denied acceptance of responsibility. He was correctly denied acceptance of responsibility. First of all, he waived that right to appeal, and United States versus Harris controlling, he has no right to appeal that. And in any event, Judge Moody was absolutely correct to deny him acceptance of responsibility. Even before this court, he denies that he's responsible for relevant conduct, and this court has held time and time again that such a denial precludes an acceptance of responsibility reduction. Unless the court has any questions, I have nothing else. I simply ask that the district court be affirmed.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Anything further, Mr. McLemore?
Counsel has argued that the evidence was overwhelming. The point I would like to leave the court with is that if the admission of the gang evidence here is permissible, it would appear to us that there's virtually no limit. We talked before briefly, Mr. Grapentian was an expert on gang affiliation. There were episodic and repeated references to gang membership throughout the trial. There were tattoos, gang tattoos, that were introduced, and I would take issue with counsel's characterization that the tattoo with the word "insane" has no inflammatory qualities. The name of the gang, Vice Lords, was emphasized repeatedly throughout the trial, and there was evidence that the gang was involved in illegal activities, and this circuit has said that
the gang should adopt more favorable names.
Well, if a gang has an unfavorable name, the point is that if you emphasize it...
The point of my question is, how can a gang, by adopting a name that decent people find repulsive, prevent the name from being used?
Well, they could do it generically and testify that someone was a member of a gang and not a gangster disciple or a vice lord or a black disciple. That is prejudicial, Your Honor. The illegal activities were also emphasized. There was the gang war evidence that was put on. There was nothing that any of these three defendants did apparently to involve themselves in the gang war, but that evidence was put on. There was evidence of an arson or a burning of a home, which was allegedly carried out by gang members. And there was also the conspicuous implication throughout the trial that the gang itself was directly involved in cocaine trafficking. Our point, which we would like to leave the court with, is that this crosses the line and that the judgment should be reversed.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. McKellis, anything further?
Just very briefly, the defendant, Mr. Johnson, answered the questions as he did during the plea colloquy because, as he indicates in his letter and the motion, that he felt that he was basically going along with the program and he didn't understand what was about to happen to him despite his statements to Judge Moody. You know, they tell us there's three kinds of people who understand a simple fact when it's communicated to them. people who need to be told a story before they understand what's happening, and somebody for whom a picture needs to be drawn before they understand what's happening. And I think Mr. Johnson perhaps falls into the third category, and when he saw the PSI, he realized his horrible misunderstanding of what was occurring, and on that basis that he's asking to withdraw us.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. Mr. Vitalis, Mr. McLemore, and other defense counsel, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment and the assistance you've been both to your clients and to us. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.